My special guest today is Jeff Keltner. Jeff is the Senior Vice President of Upstart. As Upstart's fifth employee, Jeff has run business development opportunities, including new product areas, strategic partnerships, and other investments since Upstart's inception through its IPO and beyond. Jeff is passionate about Upstart's mission to partner with banks and credit unions to make credit as effortless and available to as many customers as possible based on true risk. He also hosts the Leaders in Lending podcast, where he discusses the future of financial services industry with the consumer lending executives and other leaders in the space. Prior to Upstart, Jeff worked at Google for 6 years, where he was the first business person focused on what is now Google Cloud. He spent time launching and running the education business, Global 200 account marketing, and Chrome for business areas. He holds a computer engineering degree from Stanford and has more than 20 years of experience in sales, marketing, and business development. Wow. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
I'm old. And one quick correction, 5 years, 11 months at Google. I don't want anybody looking me up in the system and saying I didn't make 6 years, which is true. I didn't quite make 6 years. That's close.
That's good. You're self-reporting there. Well, do you want to just give folks, that's our rundown of your background. When people say, what's your background? How do you describe yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously was a computer engineer by training. I've never professionally coded since I graduated from college. I had a couple summer jobs. And I don't think I think my code is worthy of being paid for at this point. But I kind of have always been on the technical side, and I've kind of built my career at that intersection you call sales, marketing, business development, but kind of where the rubber meets the road, where the technology goes out into industry, meets customers, whether that was at IBM selling, mainframes, onto Google selling clouds, kind of different experiences there, and then coming here to Upstart and kind of the fintech. And really, I think, again, where AI technologies meet the actual application of the customers who are going to use it in terms of our banks and credit union partners.
That is a whirlwind self-description of a career that's very impressive. But I think our audience wants to hear about Upstart. It's kind of a big deal. You guys had your IPO. For those in the audience who aren't too familiar with your company, like, how do you describe Upstart? I know it's credit and you're giving loans, but what makes Upstart special?
Yeah, I mean, the core, I always start with the core problem we saw in the market. And there was kind of one we saw at the beginning and one we realized as we got into it, which I think is part of any entrepreneur story. And the core initial insight was that there are many more Americans who are credit worthy than to whom credit is offered, right? So if you do some studies, we did one with a credit bureau, and they said like 80% of Americans, more than 80, have never defaulted on a credit obligation. And yet less than half have a credit score that would qualify them for a traditional bank type loan. And we just thought that was crazy. And then in a world of extra data, machine learning, there was an ability to identify better who was credit worthy. And that should both allow more people access to credit, lower the cost of credit. Because of course, every dollar of interest paid by a borrower who pays back was really, a penalty paid because the lenders couldn't figure out if you were going to pay back or not, right? So people are paying too much. And then the problem we came to along the way was that not only is credit not as available as it should be and more expensive than it should be, but it was harder to get. The process was a pain. And so we set about applying the same kind of technologies to how do we reduce the friction. So you saw that in the mission statement, to enable effortless credit based on true risk. And those are really the two areas where we say, if the use of technology and particularly artificial intelligence can really expand access to, reduce the cost of, and reduce the friction involved in getting credit products. And that's really what we do. We do it in partnerships with banks and credit unions. So we really are powering programs with our partners. And then I guess the key thing that people probably know us for is we started in the personal lending space, which is kind of the purest form of credit in some way, because like there's no house to take, there's no car, there's no collateral. So it's a pure underwriting problem. It's not a, hey, as long as I get a big enough down payment or I've got a lien on a vehicle that's worth more than the loan, then like, it's okay if I'm wrong every now and then. Like, you have to be right about the underwriting because you have no recourse. And so we started there, but we're now working with our partners in auto retail lending, auto refi lending, smaller dollar lending, small business lending, and we'll be getting into other areas. But that's where we started.
That is, the idea is that you're now helping other organizations to determine credit worthiness, right? So are you a B2B business at this point instead of being direct B2C?
Yeah, we have both a B2B2C, if you will, where we're kind of powering the experiences for our bank and credit union partners. Still really we're focused on the delivery of an exceptional consumer experience. So we're not just kind of like a pure back-end SaaS player or something. We're really focused on how do we deliver that top-notch customer experience, both in terms of who qualifies and at what rate, but also just the experience of going through and getting a loan. And then we also have a B2C component, which is we found that many of our bank and credit union partners are looking to grow their customer base and are not sure how to reach new customers with these products. Maybe a personal loan is not a product they've traditionally marketed a lot. So we have a marketplace for our lenders where a consumer can come to upstart.com, can see what rates they could be offered from our lending partners, find the best match and originate a loan with that partner. So there is a B2C component to that that's pretty large for us because I think most of the banks just aren't experts in the digital acquisition channels. And so that digital first customer is one that they're looking for ways to find and we help them do that as well.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about how this all happens. So like why is there's not, people aren't getting credit who need it. People who want to give credit aren't giving credit. That's their business. They're not able to find these people. And you wanted to make a better experience. You wanted to do
so many things better to talk about.
I know, right. So like, how did you, obviously you've done it because you guys have gone public recently and it's working and you're here talking to me and not out there trying to make sales or something. Like how does Upstart do this differently? Like how do you actually achieve the mission in a way that others can't?
So, you know, I'm going to say that the kind of magic buzzword, which is AI, and then I'm going to get into the details because I think AI is one of these buzzwords that people use. And I feel like that in crypto, like if you say AI and crypto enough times, like some sort of venture capitalist appears and funds your startup before you even have one. You'll joke if you threw enough Patagonia vests in a pile, a venture capital firm would emerge from the thing.
Right. So,
you know, I think a lot of people say it, but the reality is doing it right is really hard, right? As my CEO sometimes says, Serena Williams and I both play tennis, but I don't like my chances on the court. Right. And so, you know, a lot of people are using AI, but doing it well is a hard problem that takes a long time to get right. But if you really think about at the core, what was happening is most, you know, this surprises most people, like a credit file. If you call a bureau and go, here's Jeff, what do you know about him? They'll give you like over 1,000 pieces of information about Jeff's financial history. And yet most of us are familiar with a 3-digit number, which for a typical lender encapsulates all 1,000 pieces of information we might have, right? And then we maybe put a debt to income limit or a couple other factors, but mostly we're relying on a singular score, right? That is summarizing in a very lossy way, for as a technical term, maybe I'll use, all the data we have about someone's past credit history. In addition, for a lot of people, credit history, if you're a 23-year-old who just graduated college or a 19-year-old who graduated high school and started work, you probably have like, you look at that file and go, nothing here, right? It doesn't say anything about you. And then to most lenders, that's risky. And so we augmented both looking at the credit file in more depth with, hey, what else can we ask a consumer that might help us understand their ability to make payments? Like maybe it's their level of education, right? What kind of things did you study if you went to college? What kind of job do you have? What kind of industry is it in? How long have you been employed there? What company employs you? These are all things we ask a consumer. But it turns out when you look at the specifics of the credit file, right? Number one, in much more depth, all those 1,000 plus things you can know. You ask the consumer other information that can fill in the gaps that might not be in a credit file, right? And then you supply sophisticated algorithms that are trying to look at all that data and understand what predicts risk. And risk, I think this is a really important factor for a particular kind of product, right? Because here's a strange thing. What's your credit score for a $5 million mortgage? What's your credit score for a $1,000 credit card?
Very different.
It turns out they're the same. But they're really not the same product, right? You only have one credit score. And so when you're trying to take that score and apply it to a $1,000 credit card and a $5 million mortgage, I mean, California, so that's like a mortgage some people actually would get around here. You know, it's just kind of bizarre that they're the same. And so when you take those algorithms and start to ask them very specific questions, like, can Jeff make the payments on a $10,000 loan over 3 years? Right? Then you can get a much better understanding of the risk of giving that loan to that customer. In a world where risk is overestimated, that means you can approve a lot more people and you can lower the cost of borrowing for a lot of people who are already approved, right? And that's just the nature of being in a world where credit was misunderstood and is generally overpriced and underavailable.
You're finding new features, new questions you can ask the consumer that other banks or lenders aren't asking. What was your major? Things about that person that aren't collected. You're also mining the credit file more deeply and with a more nuance than anyone else is. But you're also asking a different question, not just how creditworthy is this person, what's their credit score, but how creditworthy are they for a product?
Or this and, product, this duration. And we actually, this interesting thing about the way our technology works, so you're listening to this interesting. We actually, when somebody comes in and applies for a personal loan, we will actually calculate what we would charge them for every amount of loan we offer and every duration. So it's like we're actually pricing like 100. I don't know what, I haven't done the math on how many it is, but a large number of offers for that consumer. Because, you know, if they want a $1,000 loan over 3 years or a $50,000 loan over 7 years, like those are, they're very different risks for those products, right? And we want to make sure that we're pricing based on the actual risk. They might not qualify for all of those, right? So you're there. It, we talked about AI. So let me tell you a little bit about AI is like how you look at 1,000 variables or 2,000 variables. But the thing that it does that's interesting, and I think is important to understand, is like, how do you weigh off all these factors, right? Like, let's say I have a high credit score, but a high debt to income ratio. One of those is good. One of those is bad. How do I think about that? Does it matter what the credit score is in that situation? Does it matter what the income is? Does it matter what kind of debt you have? All those things probably do matter. And it becomes the kind of nuance of looking at how all these pieces of information you have aren't just singular bits of data, but they interact, right? How much one thing matters depends a lot on the other things, right? And so those are like, let's take a simple example. Your college major, which is one of the things we do use, what area of study do you have? If you're 22 and you've never had a credit product, it's kind of important, right? If you're 65 and you've paid off 2 mortgages and 8 cars, it's less important, right? Because we have other ways to look at your creditworthiness. Mm. And so the importance of using machine learning and the difficulty in doing it well is understanding how to take all these things and then combine them, because some of them are going to say things that look positive. Some of them are going to say things that look less positive. And you got to figure out what the totality of that information tells you about the risk of a particular loan to a particular person. And that kind of combining of those factors and understanding how the value of one impacts the importance of another, that's a large part of what makes it possible to be so much more accurate, but also makes it hard to do well.
And that's where you're actually applying the machine learning and the AI. You've got probably a team of analysts who sit around and think, what can we ask someone? What's the information we should put into the model? And their job is to say, to think like a human creatively kind of can, what would be some different information we can collect than anyone else does? But once you start collecting that information, You started discussing, you know, the actual problem of balancing different features in the model against each other. And that's where the AI can really shine.
What they call the model training process really does. Some of it's asking new questions, but some of it's just being clever about what you already know. For instance, we have a lot of, I'll give a simple example. We don't use where someone lives. And it's like, you know, there's a lot of history with drawing lines on maps about where we do and don't live. And so we don't use that. But there are things we can learn that we may not be obvious, like what's the average cost of living where you are? What does it cost to rent a typical house? What do groceries cost? What's the gas price, right? Which, again, if you're making $100,000 a year, that's pretty good. If you're living in Manhattan, the amount of free cash flow available to make a particular loan payment is less than if you're living in Des Moines. And so understanding how we can take information we already have and be smarter about how we use it. How do we put that into a cash flow analysis and think about it in a more detailed way? The analysts spend a lot of time doing that. And the second part, you know, we talked about the specific loan obligation. What you're actually asking the model to predict is really important. And when we started, we didn't have a lot of data, so you couldn't ask it a very sophisticated thing. So we'd ask it something like, is this person going to pay back or not? But it turns out it really matters when someone might default. If you're predicting they're going to default in month 2, that's really bad. And if it's a 5-year loan and they're going to make 59 payments and default on the 60th, like that changes the economics of the loan dramatically. And so as you start to get more sophisticated, you go, let's ask the model a better question, which is how likely is Jeff to pay the first month, the second month, the third month, all 60 months of the payment, which it turns out gives you a very different answer and a much more precise way to understand risk and price. So there's little things like that that are not obviously improvements, but can be big improvements in how effective a model can be at predicting what you want it to predict.
Why do you think other institutions haven't done this kind of thinking? Like, as you're explaining it to me, it makes a lot of sense. And this is how I want to be treated as a consumer. You know, I want to be, I want my circumstances to be taken into account and someone to intelligently think what's going to happen with this person, you know, what's their credit situation. But why haven't other banks and institutions done this? I recently applied for credit and they looked at my score and that was about it. You know, why wasn't the bank that I was working with thinking this way?
There's a couple answers, right? So most of the fintechs that came in, I'll start there and then I'll go to the banks, I think really focused on digitizing the process. And I will make a big difference between the kind of frictionless process we envision and just a digital process, right? There's a version that's like, I used to ask you for 10 documents in the branch, and now I ask you for 10 uploads of PDFs. Right. And there's a version where I don't. And those are the digitization gets, I think, confused with automation and using a lot of sophisticated technologies to reduce the friction. But most of the fintechs were like, let's just digitize. That's the thing we got to do. Everybody wants to do it online. Let's do it online. And so the credit wasn't the problem they were solving. The problem they were solving was like having to walk into a branch and fill out a piece of paper. And it took 3 days to apply for a loan. So they did what they wanted to do very well. This wasn't the problem that they tackled. And this is a hard problem because you've got to not only be right, but you have to convince the people with the money to actually fund loans. That's your right, which takes time, right? Like you originate your first loan using a fancy model and it's like a lower credit score. And the bank goes, I would never approve that. What are you doing? And you go, just trust me. Just wait 6 years and you're going to see that I'm totally right. Right. So it's a hard problem to build the credibility and to get there. And then I think if you look at it from a bank's point of view, and this is not to disparage banks, but generally their goal, I think that the lossiness in the system is in some ways hidden from the way they think about it, because they're worried about, are my losses what I expected? Or am I losing? Are my people defaulting more than I thought? And it turns out you can use an inaccurate model, but if it's accurate enough, you can say, hey, I want 3% losses. And I got 3% losses and I'm happy with that. Now, you got that by denying a bunch of people that turned out would have paid you back and you didn't know, but you didn't suffer the thing you were really trying to prevent, which is like really high defaults. And so I think when you think of the problem that way, and if you're a bank that's got a good high loan to deposit, you know, deposit to loan ratio, whether you're lending out the right amount of money, then this isn't naturally a problem that you're trying to solve. You're saying, hey, I'm lending out all the money I want to lend out. I'm having the losses I want to have. It doesn't seem like a broken, from that point of view, it doesn't seem like a broken system. Now, if you're the consumer who was told no, it feels pretty broken. But I think that we didn't always make that connection to what the system's inaccuracy was imposing, not a burden on banks, right, so much as it was on consumers. And that was, I think, the thing that we were maybe not blind to, but didn't appreciate the magnitude of as an industry, and where we kind of came in and said, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to fix this. And I think people have tried, you know, a lot of this manual underwriting. I mean, automated underwriting is new to a lot of banks. Mm-hmm. And you can't do this kind of stuff until you're fully automated. And a lot of them say, well, we do this. It's called compensating factors. When a loan officer sees a low credit score, they look for compensating factors. But that's, of course, a very subjective thing. Not everybody gets asked the same questions about, you know, compensating factors. And it's not a rigorous statistical what actually tells you if someone's, it's what I think is going to make a difference. And the beauty of machine learning is it's not what I think or you think. Our machine learning guys have had theories and they try and train the model. The model says you're wrong. That's not a good predictor. And we go, we need to find things that statistically predict default, not that we think indicate high creditworthiness or high trustworthiness or whatever it is. We have to look for the things that actually statistically prove out to be predictive of repayment behavior.
I gotcha. So banks are solving the digitization problem, which seems like it should have been solved a long time ago, but maybe that's still a problem for some places. But you're really solving a different problem. And I want to talk a little bit more about something you mentioned, which sounded a lot like backtesting to me. Because you're mentioning that there's this kind of chicken and egg problem of getting banks to trust you, because you're saying you're denying folks, you can make money off of them, you can fund loans that weren't funded otherwise, but there wasn't a lot of history to back up what you're saying, right? And you're the fifth employee over at what is now a public company. So you got to see that problem be solved. And I think that's a problem that a lot of technology and fintechs that are startups trying to get bigger have is trust us, right? Like, we found a better way, a better mousetrap. We can do this differently. But there isn't enough data to backtest and say, you know, if you had trusted us, this is what would have happened. And since you don't have that data, you can't get anyone to trust you, and you're stuck in this chicken and egg problem.
It's a chicken and egg problem. So it exists on two levels that we can talk about, right? One is the actual technical problem, which is like, I've never originated loans with my model, so I don't have data. Like, my training data is not my own data. I've got to go acquire the data. If I'm asking new questions, You know, I can't, like, I can get a retro of credit bureau data, but I can't get my education data or other data to put into my model. So I actually don't have, I've got to generate my own data. That's a real technical problem. We solved that a little bit. I mean, like I said, you can do back tests. There are some publicly available information, and we had to, you know, our model had to be different than our end result would have, what we would have wanted it to be. Because, for instance, we were using data from the Department of Education on 3-year student default loans of different kinds of universities and combining that with credit data. But of course, it was not the same borrower that we had those two pieces of information. It's two totally different data sets. And right. So you've got this kind of amalgamation of things that you, once we had originated enough loans on our own platform, we could say, oh, we don't need all that data. We're just going to use the portfolio to do it. So there's a technical problem. How do I actually get the model going and kind of find ways to kickstart my data and collect, right? And then build up to where I can get more comfortable. The second part is the business model problem, which is, even if I've done this work, this hard thing to take five different disparate data sets that aren't my own, and I built the model, I'm sure the model's better. How do I, like, prove that to somebody to get buying? And that really was a process of, you could do some back testing, right? If the model's based on credit data, you can go apply it to somebody else's portfolio and go, like, here's all the people we, you know, you can at least say, here's the people we would have denied that you approved, and you can be right. Of course, the problem is, you go, here's all the people you denied that we would have approved. And they go, well, would they have paid back? And I go, I don't know. You didn't lend to them. So it's kind of hard to say. Right. Sometimes they got a loan from somebody else and you can see if they pay that back. So, you know, there's ways to look at it. But what we really had to do was find a couple of partners. You don't need a ton, but a couple of partners that were willing to come in. You know, the return targets we were getting for the people who were funding these loans was higher than we would have wanted in the early days. There was a premium placed on. So we had to be a lot better. Right. So there's like a segment of customers who were a little smarter, and we couldn't actually win them because our cost of funding was the delta in our cost of funding was higher than we were smarter about that borrower. So we, like, even though we knew you got too high a rate, we had to charge you 2% profit for the investor more than the other guy. And that covered up our smarterness on the rate. And then we had to put some guardrails on, right? Which was to say we had a minimum FICO score, right? All of our partners started with that. And it was, I think it was 660 when we started, and then it went to 640. And then some of our partners eliminated it and said, hey, we trust the model. Even if they're lower than 640, we're going to believe that your model's right as long as it says at least. But that was like a process over time. So we had to find the right guardrails and incentives, right, to get partners in early, to give them a little bit more upside in the case we were right, to put some guardrails on the downside in case we were wrong. And then it was a slow iterative process of going back and going, hey guys, look how well this is performing. We got one guy who took away the credit score. He went down to 620. And look at this 640 to 620 pool that they originated, and look how good it looks. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't you be doing that? And people go, yeah, let me try a little bit of that. And so you kind of ease your way into going from kind of some traditional metric guardrails into a more fully trusted version of the model. And that took time, and it was not a simple thing. And so both on the technical level and on the business level, it takes time, it takes some guardrails, it takes iteration. And that's why I think it's not the, like, digitization is an easier problem to solve. This is a hard chicken and egg problem. But I also think it means that over time, it's a more defensible advantage to have because it is so hard to build. I remember our CEO, Dave, would ask me all the time, like, just how hard is this to do? And I'd say, it's really hard. Awesome. You know, good. Yeah. He'd say, good, because that makes it that much harder for anybody else to come and attack us once we've done it, right? So in some ways, when you're solving the hard problem, you got to know the hard problem. It's hard for everybody else too. And if you're the one solving it, you get an advantage and you get a moat when you're tackling that problem.
Fascinating. So the chicken and egg problem is actually a good thing. It's why you're in a defensible business. And it sounds like in my world of, like, quantitative hedge fund financial predictions and modeling, we talk about alpha as, you know, being the extra profit you can get out of your model versus someone else's model that allows you to make a profit trading. Sounds like there was enough alpha in your predictive models of credit worthiness that you can make a profit lending. And you built the case for that originally using not less than ideal methods. You're not able to say, the loan and here's what happened. You have to build it off of other data sets and build the case for those early adopters who say this is worth the risk with some guardrails, because eventually there was enough alpha in the predictive model to say, look, this is profitable. That's where you built that critical mass.
That's right. And the number, as your model gets smarter, the number of consumers upon whom you can generate that kind of alpha increases, right? Because we still would say our model is, you know, if you really think about what lending should be in its ideal state, because it's easy to get caught up on loss rates and predictive value and area under the curve or whatever we have our own specific accuracy metrics we like that we think are particular to lending. But like at the end of the day, every loan that was approved was overpriced if it pays back. And every loan that defaults never should have been given. And when you really get down to like, you should have a zero loss rate, right? And an 80% approval rate, and everybody should be getting 4%. Then you look at even our model and you go, man, I know we're doing way better than a lot of traditional approaches, but man, we're a long way from what we think of as really the perfect model. And that's iterative. So every time we rev the model, we do it regularly. Every couple of weeks, we're revving the model. Maybe it's just retraining on, you know, every day somebody pays us back, somebody goes delinquent, somebody recovers, somebody charges off. And that's data the model can use to get smarter about decisions it should have made. And then we're always working on improving it. And so every rev, we get a little smarter about loans we should approve, loans we shouldn't approve, what we should charge for people. And the universe of people that we understand better than the market by a substantial enough amount to go and win that business, it grows larger every rev of the model. And so that's the thing about AI. Like, it just keeps getting better. And it's not like you do it once and then you're done. Like, it's an ongoing process to make that model better. And then, of course, for us to apply it to new kind of asset classes, because you go from a personal loan to an auto loan, man, that's the whole vehicle to put into your model now, right? This is a whole nother set of data and features and things to think about. But this problem exists in every kind of consumer credit. So we're, you know, for us, a lot of what we're looking at now is how do we go from personal loans where we feel like we've got, you know, like I said, a long way from perfect, but a very good model to other asset classes that we haven't even gotten involved with.
Right. And it gets better, cheaper, faster all the time, the longer you work on it. We've talked a lot about the model and how you actually apply the AI and what's going on your end and the folks who are giving the loans, what's in it for them, you know, being able to make loans they wouldn't have otherwise. Can we talk about the consumer side of it a little bit more? I was on your website this morning reading blogs about people who cut their loan payment for their car. Yep. That was the top loan this morning. Is someone financed a loan through your platform that was cheaper and now they're saving money every month and they could apply that to saving up for a home. Can you talk a little bit about the mission here? Like the people who actually save money through this process, are you able to see the impact in their lives kind of on a daily basis because they got a cheaper loan?
Yeah, we do. And it's one of those things that I think in finance of any sort is important to remember. Like, I think you can easily turn this into like a video game kind of thing where you're looking at the numbers and tweaking this and that. And it's easy to get removed from like the real human beings whose lives you're impacting. Right. And so we actually, one of the things we do is we read a borrower review or two every week. We have an all hands meeting on Friday afternoon for the whole company. And we go through like, here's a borrower story about where they were and what they did and what they use the loans for. Our personal loans are mostly used to refinance credit cards. So usually somebody's going from, hey, I racked up $10,000 of credit card debt and I don't know how I'm ever going to pay it off because it's got this weird payment structure. And we get them into an installment loan, a fixed payment over a fixed period of time, and they're on a path out of that debt. And that's a really powerful moment for a lot of people, particularly who got themselves into what they felt like was an untenable position. And then obviously for auto refi, it's just kind of like you're generally taking somebody lowering their payment and giving them, you know, more affordable loan payment because you understand their credit risk better. And the, you know, we have a net promoter score in the 80s, like I think it's like 82 right now among our borrowers, which is for financial services exceptionally high. And I think that really speaks to the ability to really well serve our consumers. That's what got us into the business, right? Was the sense that there were people, you know, we really fundamentally believe that credit is the enabler of opportunity and mobility, right? Like most people who make it or successful in improving their lives use credit along the way to do it, whether that's credit for your first car, credit for college, right? Credit for your first home. Like credit unlocks opportunity for people. And when credit's not as available or is too expensive, it limits the number of people who can access that opportunity, who can access that mobility. And so to us, that really was the starting point, was how do we make the American dream, opportunity, mobility, more available, less expensive, and do that through, you know, making credit more available and less expensive. So we try and keep very well connected to that because I think it's really important. It's easy to lose sight of, right? I can get spreadsheets all day long with all sorts of numbers that we want to tweak this way and that way. And how do we want to do this? And at the end of the day, you got to remember the human being on the other end who's trying to buy a car, who's trying to buy a house, who's trying to pay for college, who's trying to get a credit card debt, and that you're trying to enable that for them. And make that possible in less expensive form.
Yeah, I love that you're reading that at your all staff meeting because it's super personal. It's like you save someone even $100 a month, that might make a huge difference for them on a personal level and enable them to do to expand their financial possibilities in a huge way. And because I imagine you've got a very technical team, like these are people building machine learning and AI models and marketing that as a product and things like that. So keeping them connected to the human factor. I love that idea. I need to do more of that at my company, is like, who are we helping and why? That's a really,
we actually have a Slack channel for all of our Trustpilot, like as Credit Karma Trustpilot reviews come in, we've integrated them into Slack. So you can see, and they're not all positive, right? And we'll flag negative ones and go, hey, what happened here? Like, what was the problem? Like, what went wrong? But that's nice that we highlight one or two every week for that. And I think it is really important, right? Because like, you can, if you're a data scientist, you can go, you know, our preferred metric is NPV-RMSE, which is like an acronym of acronyms. But the root mean squared error of the net present value of a lent dollar in our model, like how wrong are we about the return investor will use? Because kind of like, you know, versus like an AUC, we think it's a lending specific accuracy metric that's really good. So the NPVRMSE, it's like, who even knows what that means? NPVRMSE is up 5%.
Right.
Like, do we feel good? I don't know. Like, and it's important to measure, right? It's important to understand. But I think it's also really important from a motivation and a mission point of view to go, hey, we were able to help more people this month than last month. And importantly, we actually launched a new initiative just today. We kind of helped launch this alliance called More Than Fair. And this is, I think, an element that's easy to forget, is that the inaccuracy of our current credit system does not fall evenly upon different communities, right? There are communities that we call underserved.
Sure.
And so More Than Fair was a statement that, like, sometimes we think about fairness, and fairness is an important metric. I don't want to, we do all sorts of fairness testing on our AI modeling, but I think it's also important to remember that inclusiveness and accessibility are in cost are equally important. And a model that leaves out a lot of people but is fair by some metrics, we think we can aim for more than fair. We think we can aim for more inclusive, for accepting more borrowers. So we've done some statistics, and like, you know, our model approves 46% more Hispanic borrowers than a traditional model at 25% lower APR. Like, we look at those numbers, and, you know, 43% more Black borrowers at 25%. Like, those are really important metrics to us. And we think that not only can we help the average consumer, but of course, when the inaccuracy of the current model falls disproportionately on particular groups, solving that inaccuracy can help those groups even more so than the average, which we think is also one of those things we measure, because I think it really impacts us and how we think about the mission and what we're doing and how we're improving the financial health of the American consumer, but the fairness and inclusivity of the American financial system.
If so, you're looking at that metric and saying, if we aren't lending at equitable rates, at just rates, at fair rates, different communities, it's not that community's fault, and we're not going to just deny them credit to avoid a default. It's your challenge is to say, how can we adjust the model so that we're not being biased, but we aren't having disparate impact either?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do a lot of fairness testing on the model, right? Like, there's all sorts of disparate impact kind of standards and testing. We've worked very closely with the CFPB to do that, to build testing on that front. But I think we want to move past the testing of, like, is the model, and go, like, how many more consumers in these categories can we bring into the ability to borrow than were there before? Like, if we were using a FICO-centric model, you know, unfortunately, the average African American's credit score is lower than the average white American's credit score. That's just true. If you use a hard credit score cutoff, you're going to disproportionately cut off people in minority communities. That's just the state of the world for all sorts of historical reasons. But a smarter model that can remove that hard credit score requirement and start to look at and assess the borrowers underneath can disproportionately help those communities. And that's one of the things we measure, not only the fairness, but like, how much are we able to actually help those communities and bring them into, lower the cost of borrowing for them, make borrowing more available to them, because that availability of credit is really important in and outside of the kind of question of fairness. Are you expanding access equitably among the groups? Is a good question. Is your model accurate equitably among the groups? That is a good question. But the question of, like, can we expand access to credit and help people who were being denied before is, I think, an equally important question.
Yeah. What a fun problem to solve, because you're getting the feedback of people are getting financed all the time, but I'm sure you can see them a smarter model as you build it, because you've got metrics to tell you.
We watch it every iterative, like, how much smarter is it? And of course, we compare ourselves to ourselves mostly. Like, we compare it to traditional approaches, but then you want to go, hey, are we getting smarter? Are we getting better? And is that better actually increasing in the number of people we can serve and lowering the cost for the people we're already serving, which it should. And we continue to monitor and make sure that it does.
Right. I love it. The website's upstart.com, for our audience who's not familiar with it. How do you recommend people learn more about Upstart? Is it just coming to the website and checking it out? What's the best way for the audience to check it out?
You can come to the website. We've got a couple of pages on LinkedIn. Until I took a little break this summer, I was pretty active on LinkedIn. So that's the easiest way to get a hold of me probably versus it's the only social media I use. So don't try and hit me up somewhere else. I'm on everything, but I'm not on anything. If that makes any sense. I got a handle everywhere and I had to look at it is what I'm trying to say. But LinkedIn's a good place. And Upstart.com, there's a specific site of that for lenders. So for banks or credit unions or fintechs that are curious about the technology, the kind of B2B, if you will, side, there's a specific section of the site for that as well because the site is a little consumer oriented. But that's probably the best way. And then, of course, since we went public, you can always read our quarterly filings and listen to the earnings calls.
You can get those from Intrinio. That's what we do.
I will say that this is maybe a strange answer to your question, but the founder's letter in our S1 is one of the best descriptions of our business and how we think about it and how it operates. A lot of time and energy went into that by our three co-founders. And it is, if you're very curious about the business, it is well worth the read because it is the best summary I've seen of how we think about what we do. That's out there. It's a couple of years old now, but the best documents stand the test of time. And I think that one will.
Interesting. That's a great answer because I wouldn't have thought of it. And I think the audience that wants to learn about Upstart would do well to check that out. Hopefully we can put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
Jeff, it's a real pleasure learning about your business. It's a unique approach. I think people are going to learn from you about a different way to lend and a smarter way to lend that not only creates some alpha because it creates loans for people who wouldn't otherwise get them, but I think it's going to change some things in the world due to making more people credit worthy, helping to fund some of those loans that wouldn't otherwise get lent. So thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us about it. It was a real pleasure, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.